This is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills, and I am your host, Miriam Atkin. Today I have here with me in the studio, Athens and New York City-based interdisciplinary artist, Patrick Costello. And I will start by reading a brief bio for him. Patrick Costello is an artist whose work comes alive through multi-species collaborative relationships, integrating practices of ecological horticulture, sculpture, printmaking, and performance. He has exhibited at the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit, Socrates Sculpture Park, and Stone Quarry Hill Art Park. He has performed in venues including Ars Nova, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, the Public Theater, and at intentional communities, squats, and underground venues around the world. Most recently, Patrick received a McDowell Fellowship. He holds an MFA from Hunter College and a BA from the University of Virginia. So what first struck me about your work was how wide-ranging it is and also how prolific you are. In looking at your recent projects, I'm seeing large-scale sculpture, participatory performance, stop-motion animation, community happenings, and other types of work. And so, to show your range, I thought it would make sense to start off by discussing two of your recent works. One is a planted installation called And Eat It Too, and the other is an interactive installation called Privy Privy. So I'm just wondering if you can describe these two pieces for the audience.
Sure. So And Eat It Too is a sculpture that is at Stone Quarry Hill Art Park in Cazenovia, and it is a piece that is going to compost itself back into its site over the course of a couple of years. And it's a piece that I'm really interested in because of all the relationships that made it possible and all the sort of ecosystems that form around it. I mean, all art is part of some collection of ecosystems, and I was sort of trying to figure out how to make a piece that would be more intentionally part of certain ones or kind of facilitate certain kinds of ecosystems and communities. So that piece is kind of an ongoing time-based piece because it's evolving every day as it sinks back into the earth and grows weird things. And it's kind of a collaboration too between me and the people who work at the art park and who are there all the time, the grounds maintenance people and all of that.
So and it's pretty massive, right?
Like, yeah.
What's the scale of it?
It's 14 feet tall mm-hmm. by 14 feet wide, and it's kind of tiered. The base is hay bales, and then there's soil and these kind of burlap sacks that are filled with elephant dung, wood chips, straw, compost, some other things. So, and then the whole thing is seeded and planted on top.
Do you have, trying to think of a good way to describe the shape of it?
It's kind of like a tiered cake, which is kind of where the title comes from. I was excited about making a compost heap that was also something celebratory, mm-hmm. Like the earth could eat it too, have its cake and eat it too. Just because I think that so much work that contains climate anxiety or that is about things growing and composting, it's oftentimes a little more serious or kind of science coded in science terms or coded in sort of that climate anxiety. And I'm sort of like, there's also a lot of like celebration and joy that that we're all gonna eventually just like be eaten by microbes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very striking. I mean, I haven't seen it in person, but just the scale of it and the fact that you manage to plan the planting in such a way that it looks both wild and very intentional and like decorative, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I work as a landscaper and gardener as my day job and have for a long time. So at this point, I'm like a amateur landscape architect. Mm. So there is a palette of plants that I use a lot in my work and as a garden designer. And so those plants, I was really able to sort of manipulate the aesthetic a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the funnest thing was that it was the first time that I got to get a bunch of people together from the art park and my regular collaborators and plants and just see what could be made with a bigger budget.
Mm-hmm.
The art park got a NISCA grant to fund it, and I got a Puffin Foundation grant and a Foundation for Contemporary Art grant. So there was actually money to get supplies and to be there and to work on the piece. And so it was just like the final, or like the piece that that we all see that's actively decomposing, it's like maybe one of the weirder things I've ever made or seen. Mm. I don't even know how I feel about it, but what was really amazing about it was just like figuring out all the ways that a funded time and space to make something allowed for all of these different connections to emerge around the piece. So I was working with a dear friend, Mitchell Dose, so many amazing artists and humans came to be a part of it. It was like this revolving door for a month of like people coming and going who I love and who I love what they make. And I think that was one of the most exciting things. And I've gone on to do more work with the park. Like I'm helping with some landscaping this summer. And it's just kind of amazing to have a project that just serves as a hub for building new relationships, mm-hmm. and like figuring out a new audience or a new collection of people who are supporting both the work and each other.
Right. And did you have a series of dinners that were?
There was one at the opening. We did one event where my beau, Ben Simon, was our waftoff, and he made like waffles that were topped with a bunch of different things from local farms and from all these inventive toppings, sweet and savory and otherwise, that a group of people prepared. And it was what ended up happening was that there were these plates of food that were just these piles of all the local resources and things he had brought and things he had come up with in his brain. And so people gathered there and ate and had this kind of, it was like a midday, like a brunch.
Yeah. And I think, you know, something like this, talking about it on radio, you don't get to see it. And so I'll definitely share images or links to images on the broadcast page so that people can have a sense of the scale. I'm thinking about what you just said about this feast that kind of inaugurated the piece, and I guess which brings us to Privy Privy, which is a very different kind of piece. And yet, I think it shares certain qualities.
Yeah, sure. I think, so Privy Privy is a collaboration between myself and a Philadelphia-based artist, theater maker, and writer, Donna Oblongata. We've been working together now on many different kinds of projects for about 12 years consistently, and I think that we share a belief that that like play and joy can yield a bunch of different things that they're like essential to the work and to our existence as people. And so this piece, Privy Privy, the viewer goes into this, or the audience goes into a space that's been outfitted to look like a restroom at a club or a gay bar or something, some subcultural space. And there are bathroom stalls in the space. And the first things you encounter are the ice cream man, who is a sort of leather daddy soda jerk, who's walking around with a bunch of toppings that he has been outfitted with. And then there's also a go-go dancing ice cream cone in the corner. And then you hear a soundtrack that is made of actual mixtapes from like 1977 to 1996 that we digitized for the piece. I inherited this box of mixtapes that my friend had inherited from DJs as they passed away from AIDS. And so there was this kind of amazing, like having that box of tapes and then having this excuse to digitize them, it like lends a sort of weight. Like immediately when you get in, you kind of hear the tape crackling, you hear this music, and you see this weird space that is a bathroom. And then the bathrooms, like all good bathrooms, are equipped with glory holes. And in the glory hole, instead of the appendage that you would think would come through a glory hole, it is a hand holding an ice cream cone. And so people get on their knees, and the ice cream man may come and like drizzle some caramel sauce or put some sprinkles on the ice cream. And yeah, people actually get on their knees and have this wonderful, pleasurable experience with another human, an anonymous pleasurable experience. And I think you can also get something out of it just by being in the space and like witnessing it. There's mm-hmm. some like voyeur aspect to it. And I think the basic premise, or the sort of like impetus to make the piece, came from having this box of tapes and not knowing what to do with them, but also the like maelstrom of anti-LGBTQ legislation and this whole like conversation around obscenity laws mm-hmm. and all these things, and thinking like, actually in the wake of COVID and all of these social distancing measures, the pursuit of pleasure with another body, it's something that we all actually share and need more right now. Mm. And the sort of making it obscene is a thing that like doesn't really serve anyone except for the legislators that are proposing that legislation, who are basically just homophobes.
Yeah.
So we just wanted to kind of clown that, the spate of all that legislation. We wanted to sort of turn it on its head a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, what you said about the piece emerging out of you having this collection of tapes, right, and wondering what to do with them, that sort of calls to something that I see as representative of your approach to making art in general, where you have history and history as connected to a specific community kind of bequeathing something to you. And then, you know, it's like, how do I keep this in circulation, or how do I recirculate this in some kind of ceremonial way that sort of brings that history back to life, or, you know, honors it.
Yeah. Yeah, or like composts it. Like, yeah. I think that, like, when I think about inheritance, the inheritances I have as a white person, as a cis man, as a queer person, as a person who grew up moving around but kind of identifies from being from the South, because I spent most of my teen and 20s in Virginia, in Charlottesville. And like I have all these things that are immediately just part of who I am because I sort of inherited them without choosing any of them. And some of them are kind of not things that I would want.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've always been like, well, what do we do with like whiteness, for example, something that I think is kind of awful and insidious and something that benefits me every single day, all the time. What do you do with that? Because you can't just like be like, oh no, I'm not this thing in terms of society anymore, but I might be able to sort of think about it as something we like. Compost is great because it takes all the things, the like refuse, the peels of the things that you don't eat, the things that you have no use for, and like through some alchemical microbial process, it makes ground for new things to grow. And so I just think that trying to bring in this idea that we have certain things that we want to celebrate and carry forward, and certain communities that we want to be a part of and that we want to like make stronger by the things that we bring into the world, and then also things that we want to transform, things that we want to like put to rest and make something different in their place.
Yeah.
That's the reason I think that I can't stop making art, even though a lot of the art world is not that appealing to me.
So, yeah, just to think about these two pieces in connection with each other. I really like these two examples because even though they're very different, they don't feel disparate. And they share some qualities that seem to me to be dear to you. And those are qualities that I see expressed throughout your work. And I wrote a little list of these qualities that I saw. I wanted to run them by you and see what you thought.
I love a list.
Okay. So, an interest in digesting or metabolizing and the beautiful messiness of those processes. A celebration of garishness.
Yeah, yeah.
An interest in very analog forms of togetherness and a ritualistic and symbolic redressing of suffering.
Oh, cool. Yeah, yeah.
And so we've kind of talked about some of these already, but I was wondering if there's any one of those that you feel like talking about or expounding on.
What was the second to last one again?
An interest in very analog forms of togetherness.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, that feels so central to who I am as a person and the reason that I make things. Is like, I feel like in a world where we have so many different ways of being in communication with people and being in relationship with people, and I think all of those ways are kind of cool and bring, they're all like, technology is a set of tools that we can use to communicate with the world and each other. And I think that's great, but I have always been a person who is most interested in what happens when two or more bodies share space.
Because
I think that there's something interesting around, like, how we develop empathy, how we work with each other in ways that we find surprising, how we push our own boundaries and each other's, how we self-organize, what it looks like to do the thing rather than just like see the finished thing or be or just like receive the thing. Like I think maybe it's because I grew up going to, or not grew up, but like, you know, in my late teens and early 20s, I was part of these punk communities and activist communities that were like, that were really interested, or that were really invested in like what happens when you're not just a passive observer. I remember like back in the good old days when it was like, kill your television. and because like what happens when you're like active and embodied and with other people trying something, even if it fails, or maybe because it's going to fail. And I think that that feels really core to what I do.
Yeah.
Is there another one you'd rather talk about?
Oh, no. I was just...
I loved the whole list. I was like, oh, this is so helpful. I love garishness as a quality that I'm kind of celebrating. I think like maximalism and like a sort of Baroque sense of ornamentation feels like super related to my queerness and related to like the kind of world that I think we do live in. And that I think is kind of cool.
Yes, I'm a huge fan of maximalism in all forms. And I don't know, as soon as I first checked out your website, that page, well, actually,
oh, yeah.
I mean, maybe we should talk about, so on the sort of landing page on your website is this, it's kind of like a still life, which I believe is part of your piece, My Pizza, My Idea.
Yeah.
Is that right? So, yeah, I think since we're talking about garishness, in that sense, my love for garishness is, I think, what one of the main things that got me really excited about the pizza project, because pizza is such a garish food item.
Yeah, totally. And the best food.
Yeah.
Undeniable.
So maybe you can just describe what that piece was.
Yeah. So My Pizza, My Idea is another kind of food-centric project. And it's another collaboration with Donna Oblongata. And it's seen many iterations, but the last one was at 601 Art Space in the Lower East Side. And so we set up a mobile pizza oven on the sidewalk, and we're cooking pizzas right outside the gallery space, kind of on the street, next to one of those like parking pay things, kiosks. And it was just like billowing smoke into the street all over the place. And it was so hot because it was August, and people would come into the air conditioned gallery. Many people from the neighborhood who had never been to the space before, grandmas, children, the frat boys that lived like in the apartment where smoke was billowing in their window, and they were like, what is going on? But they would come in, and the central premise was that the gallery space was a pizza making space. And so you would make your pizza and then get it out to the oven as fast as possible so it doesn't stick, and you can get it. I always forget what the name of that tool is called, the like flat metal.
I don't know what it's called.
Well, Donna will hear this someday and be disappointed that I forgot. But but then you'd put it into the oven and make your pizza. And then the rule was that you couldn't keep your pizza. You had to send it off to someone as a surprise, or you could let them know too. But so... we had this crew of uniformed cyclists that would deliver the pizzas anywhere in New York City. And you could write a message. This was something that sort of organically started happening, but you could write a message on the inside of the pizza box. And it was just this weird way of doing something distinctly analog, using an institutional space that is usually sort of like a passive space for viewing as a sort of generative active space. And an absurd and ambitious project that like delivering, you know, usually there's like a delivery radius, and our delivery radius was so absurdly large. And so the pizza might not get to the person fully intact or even warm. And so, but I liked the idea that, or Donna and I both like the idea that there's something that happens when in, especially in an urban space where there's all of these surprise interactions that shape your daily experience anyway, mm-hmm. to sort of like do a piece that just sort of foregrounds that.
Yeah. And I feel like as you're describing it, it might be hard for people to picture like what's the aesthetic dimension of this, or like how is this not just something that you do in a community center?
Yeah. So I forgot one part of the process is that when people come into the gallery, they make their pizza, they bring it out to the oven. While the pizza is cooking, they come in and screen print a pizza box.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had drawn these weird pizza slices that were talking to each other, and it said my pizza, my idea on it. And that was the print that people made, but it was a process to just teach people how to screen print. And then they would put their box together, bring it outside, get the pizza, and then send it off with the cyclist. But I just want to go back. You said that there was the landing page image on my website, mm-hmm. the still life. And I just want to go back. That was a collaboration within this collaboration with Ben Simon. And Donna and I were really interested in cultivating a sort of visual aesthetic around this like pop-up pizza place that brought in all the messiness of the world and all the weirdnesses that sort of the like sort of idiosyncratic like funny little bits that make up our collaborative practice.
Mm-hmm.
And so those things that were in that still life are just things from my house. I have like, there was yellow astroturf. I have a giant roll of it. There's like a big flocked red velvet vase that is in the thing. There's bicycle wheels, a plastic deer planter, a bunch of different salt and pepper shakers. There was just like a bunch of things, some of which had to do with pizza, and some of it was just the like detritus and interesting objects that, at least in my life, are around me all the time.
Roller skates.
Yeah.
Like there was a boombox.
Yep, boombox. That was a present to myself because I only really have cassette tapes. And mm-hmm. so I was like, yes, I'm going to get this one that you can, it has the double cassette deck so you can record tapes. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it became this really fun project where we were like, what points to pizza and what points away from pizza as this, like every part of it, we wanted it to be kind of surprising and maximal.
Mm-hmm.
And so those still lifes were, we had a series of still lifes that were displayed in the gallery, and some of the objects from the still lifes were like weird little sculptures in the gallery, and the yellow astroturf was underneath the screen printing station, and there was just this kind of coherent visual world that was kind of intentionally incoherent.
Yeah. Well, and that's...
Or at least garish. Or
right.
Maximal.
Right. I'm wondering if there are any memories or places or media or specific cultural expressions that inform that kind of maximalist aesthetic for you, or a totally. Movie or something like that.
I mean, so I went back. So my mom is from Idaho Falls, Idaho, and my grandma turned 90, I guess about 2 years ago, and the whole family went to Idaho Falls to celebrate her birthday, and the birthday happened in like a church community room down the street from my grandma's house, and my aunt and my mom put together this whole celebration that involved like a bunch of painted rocks. Everyone like painted a rock. My grandma loves painted rocks, or loved. She passed away since then, but she loved painted rocks. So there was like this whole table of painted rocks. And then it was all like kind of rodeo cowboy themed. My grandma was a barrel racer and a rodeo queen. And
what's a barrel racer?
Oh, it's an event in a rodeo where you like ride a horse, I think in a figure eight, around two barrels in the ring.
Hmm.
And you do it as fast as you can, and then
cool.
So she like
cool grandma.
Yeah, cool grandma. So and very much like informed by the sort of like American West.
Mm-hmm.
But so this party, there was so many different aspects to it. Like we had a group sing-along, a hootenanny, where we sang all of my grandma's favorite songs together, and I made these little songbooks, and then but one of the things that really like hit home for me was that there were all these snacks and treats, and my family definitely like shows love for each other through the medium of sugar. Mm-hmm. And treats. And so one of the treats that was there were these Pringles that had been covered in chocolate and then a Rolo put on the middle of the Pringle and then a little Twizzler around the Rolo so that they looked like cowboy hats like a little red like decorative band. And I saw them and was like, oh my God, I'm just doomed to make the work that my family has been making for generations, where I feel like I am my mother's son. Mm. I am my grandma's grandchild. It's like this funny thing where I was like, oh my gosh, a lot of my work is just directly informed by how we celebrated as I grew up.
Yeah.
So that's a funny thing. I do think that like maximalism and like colorful, there's that book Chromophobia that I read a long time ago and I don't even remember who wrote it, but thinking about color, thinking about ornamentation as these sort of like queer feminist spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's always something that I'm into.
Yeah, I'm thinking about what you said a few minutes ago about the aesthetic being coherent in its incoherence.
Like those cowboy hat treats.
Yeah. And this like maximalist approach to color, it's really amazing. Like when I look at that still life from My Pizza, My Idea. And I was also really drawn to the planning sketch for And Eat It Too.
Mm-hmm.
So you rendered the planted sculpture first as a cake,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so
that little planning sketch actually is a collage of, so Ben makes these cakes that mm-hmm. are really bonkers, and sometimes I'll help decorate them and pick the color of the icing or, you know, some of the decorative flourishes. And I loved the way those cakes look, they look like these ecosystems, and that was something that I was, or these kind of like maximal worlds unto themselves.
Yeah.
And that's what I was trying to duplicate with And Eat It Too, was like, I want to make a giant one of those cakes.
Right.
That was kind of like the initial seed of the thing. And it's interesting because I wanted all the color to come from the flowers that would be blooming on it.
Mm-hmm.
But in other ways, trying to figure out pigments and ways of like dyeing the burlap or like trying to figure out this like highly colorful thing that was in my head,
mm-hmm.
and then have it not be something toxic I was putting into the ground was right. really hard.
Yeah.
And so I just ended up like indigo dyeing all the burlap because mm-hmm. I was like, I know that's not going to like put something into the soil that I don't want to be there. And the blooms of the plants that I used, plants that would have been like indigenous to that area prior to European colonization, like a lot of them are pretty subtle. The mm-hmm. inflorescence or the flowers, they're like pretty subtle. And I was like, whoa, this is unintentionally kind of like quieter, even though it's big and
elegant.
Hulking.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, huh, interesting. It's like a funny thing to be really into color and maximalism and then also be a practitioner or like somebody who works with land and mm-hmm. works with plants, because it's a collision of like the sort of natural and the artificial that
yeah.
doesn't always like fit nicely into a box where I'm describing my practice in a, you know, 100 words.
Yeah, I really liked that disjunct, though. I mean, that image, the planning sketch, and like seeing that as the precursor to what actually was made, it's almost like this kind of cartoon dream. And then the analog to it, which is this more muted reality.
Well, I think there's like one of the things that that piece is, many people have responded to it and like it. I loved the process of making it, but I constantly look at it and I'm like, this is not what I set out to make really, or maybe I was too ambitious, or maybe I have this unrealistic expectation of like what, can manifest in the world.
Yeah.
And I kind of like that it didn't hit the mark for me, A, because now I have things to like scratch at and aspire to. But B, because yeah, they do have this funny thing where they kind of converse rather than just be like a simple A to B.
And that, I mean, you see that piece as something that's still in process, in the sense that it's still decomposing, right? And you have a camera stationed that photographs it every day. So it started off at 14 feet high. Do you know, like, has it gotten considerably shorter?
It's definitely gotten shorter, and it started to sort of it started to kind of melt or implode a little bit. The burlap is all coming apart, and so like this, the contents of those big tubes, which we had to fill with this really amazing like pooper machine that like attaches to a skid steer, and then you like slide the burlap onto this like long tube, and then it shoots the filling into
like
them,
a like, sausage stuffer.
Yeah, which maybe goes back to privy, but but the, it was just like this hilarious process of like making the thing, and now it has changed way more than I thought it would, way faster. And it's not growing things the way that I thought it would. Like, I think maybe it's composting and it's like hot, and it's like maybe there's not enough soil, maybe there's not enough water, but like things aren't growing the way that I want. So I was sort of like, well, maybe I'll just keep experimenting with it. So I think this summer I'm going to go back and like add some more soil as it gets shorter, and plant some more things, spread some more seeds, see what happens, because I'm sort of interested in it just being this like active experiment, since I didn't know it was gonna, I don't know too many people that are planting structures like that. So it who knows what will happen with it, but I like art that or I like aesthetic work in the world that is doing something, that like I was sort of interested in the fact that this radio show is called Specific Objects, because that Donald Judd thing, he's talking about minimalism, but I like that it emphasizes the sort of like physical and the phenomenological, like these, the experience of an object, rather than like this rarefied experience of a symbolic form or something.
Yeah.
Because like, I like that that thing was inspired by a cake that my beau made. And I like that there's something celebratory about cake, but I'm also, and that there's some kind of like metaphorical resonance there, but I also just like that it's an object in the world that's sort of unruly, and that I have to sort of calibrate myself in relationship to it. Like I want it to look beautiful as it's sinking back into the ground. And right now it looks kind of nuts. And I don't want it to look beautiful just because I'm a fascist for beauty or something. I also am concerned about the people that have to like mow around it and the people who invited me to come there and do the project. Like, I don't want, it's an interesting, like, we're all constantly juggling many registers of things, and I like that that piece requires that I do that in a kind of like consistent way over time.
Yeah. Right. Well, we have to contend with our idealization of nature. And I feel like I'm always very aware of the fact that I've inherited this kind of Victorian nature tourism orientation in the world where, yeah, there's this expectation. I think the term, the picturesque, there's this expectation of a certain kind of beauty that we want from nature. And now that I live in the mountains, you know, I'm always thinking about like the fact that when I'm walking around, I can't really say like this area that I'm walking through now is beautiful. This area is ugly. And there's a lot of ugliness, you know, and that I think it's that kind of incoherence again, where it's like, it really is this. I mean, I'm talking about a very specific landscape in the Catskill Mountains, but there's this feeling of, you know, just everything being here and everything always dying and consuming itself, and, you know, all the stages of decomposition, many of which are garish, you know? And that quality I really see reflected in your work in a weird way, because you also have this like play between the artificial and the natural. You know, this sort of plastic technicolor thing happening alongside something like the planted sculpture, which I know you've done other works like that, you know, sculptures made out of natural materials that can't be as bubbly and bright blue and, you know.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm constantly contending with that inheritance of the sort of idea of nature where you can like name it. It's a discrete object. Mm. There's a botanical Latin name. This funny inheritance that we all have, where we're looking at the landscape as if we're separate from it and as if it's supposed to provide a specific kind of beauty to us. And we name it, we control it, we understand it. And I'm sort of like, well, not only does that erase the history of all the people who lived here before, like in the Catskill Mountains prior to European colonization, but it also just erases the fact that, like, at this point we live in a place where, like, bittersweet and buckthorn and stilt grass and all of these different species are existing alongside the species that have been here since things have been documented.
Yeah.
And it's a mess. And I when I first got this piece of land with Ben, we thought that we were going to be like doing some ecological restoration project and like restoring the land to some pure ideal or some historic moment that before we sullied it or something. And it's like, that's not possible. So how do we like find joy and grossness and like sadness and the ability to transform in that mess? Like, that's kind of where I want to be.
And I'm someone who doesn't know anything about ecological horticulture. So what are some of the scientific reasons why it's not possible?
Well, I just think that the discourse around ecological horticulture, around our relationship to landscapes right now, like if we're living in the Anthropocene and we've touched everything and everything has the mark of people moving around, of all these different human-made systems, pollution, all of these things. Like, if we are living in that time, there's definitely an impulse in ecological horticulture and in landscape land management in general, where people like native plants are really in vogue, and like this idea of ecological restoration is really in vogue. And I think there is something, you know, it facilitates biodiversity, which we think is a good thing. It's like facilitates the health of all of these different creatures around the plants, who eat the berries from the plants, who use the plants as habitat. And so I'm here for that conversation. I'm also sort of interested in these species that are introduced to the space that thrive, that are consistently talked about as like exotics or invasive, or mm-hmm. and many of these species that, like stiltgrass, for instance, is like carpeting our forest floor. And I wonder what other kinds of species would be there if it wasn't just one thing. So I get it, and I'm here for the conversation around it. But like, as two people living in the world, me and Ben and our little crew of friends, there's no way that even for our 11 acres, we're going to be able to like eradicate certain species and only have certain other ones that are deemed like okay for them to be there. And I have a question about where we, if science is shaped by all the other discourses that we inherit, like, is that discourse more just about like inheriting the logic of colonialism? There's like some messiness in there that I don't have the answer to, but
right, like the question of whether you can just walk in and completely overhaul this natural space and
has already been overhauled
like
many times before we got there, and so, and which is subject to like birds traveling and pooping and like a bunch of other forces that are way beyond our control. And so I'm not saying that I guess there's some part of me that's like, we as humans are not capable of addressing the like crises of our time. They're like, maybe we're not gonna like win, but if we're gonna keep getting up every morning and like trying something, I'm sort of interested in like what happens when you're like, okay, so if we're not gonna be able to solve everything, mm-hmm. what does it look like to sort of swim in that space of in between and try to affect the things that we can with the knowledge that we have or the evidence that we have, and also just sort of be like, it's not going to be
right
perfect.
Yeah. So we're running out of time, but we've been talking about this land in Athens that I was lucky enough to get to visit the other day, and I view it as a kind of laboratory for some kind of alternate vision of how to share space and how to interact with a natural environment. I guess what I'd love for you to talk about for a bit is your history with the space and what's your vision for it.
So I lived collectively for most of my adult life in Virginia and all over the country, and most recently in New York. And I loved like navigating these spaces with other people, especially other people who needed studio space to make things. Oftentimes I lived in these converted warehouses where we would have space enough that we could have like our sewing machines set up and we could work on our bikes, and there was space for somebody to be fabricating something for a show. And that was just kind of the community of people that I've always been around. And Ben has always been involved in the Catskill region, because he like went to summer camp up here and kind of fell in love with the landscape and had a group of friends that were trying to figure out how they could be able to continue to visit and appreciate this space. And I think even though Ben and I had a lot of reservations about what it means to own property and be landowners, we were sort of like, we want to set up a space where the decades of our communities could come together and have space to make things, have space to try things out with plants, with learning new skills, mm-hmm. and just space to be together that wasn't gonna go away because the rent got raised or whatever. And so for a year and a half, we looked for something to buy, and we kept revisiting this one piece of land in Athens for about 8 months, and we kept coming back to it and coming back to it, and we downloaded these hunting apps onto Ben's phone so that we could see the boundaries of the thing and really see, like, oh, that beautiful mama oak is, like, on the property, and oh, this thing over here is not. The pond of peepers is actually on the neighbor's land, but we can still hear it. Mm-hmm. And so we just kind of got to know what species were growing, what things were there, and then it's been this slow process of, like, selectively clearing part of, like, since we got it, which was, we put the offer in March 8th, 2020, not knowing that it was going to be
oh, wow.
Everything changing.
Yeah, good timing.
And so it's just a piece of land with nothing on it. We put in a driveway and a well, and we've and then the first structure we built was this kind of cathedral-like A-frame outhouse with a stained glass window. And we were like, okay, we have a place to go to the bathroom. We have a way to get the car into the place. And we have access to non-potable water. Great. The basics are here. And since then, we've hosted a variety of events. There was Donna had a musical that she did a workshop for that was a week of performers on the land getting this thing up and running. And we also do an annual event called Mothball. And Mothball is a collaboration between me and an Ithaca-based artist, Ash Ferlito. And it's a night of performative spectacle and mothing, which for people who don't know what mothing is, I'll tell you. It's the scientific practice of observing moths in a given area. You hang up a white sheet, you shine a long wavelength light bulb on the sheet, and over the course of the night, moths, I think 90% of which are nocturnal, are attracted to the light and land on the sheet, and they usually stay there a while, so you can get a pretty accurate understanding of what species are in the area. And it's one part total nerdiness, one part really far out performances. Mm-hmm. We've had dance pieces and group sing-alongs and weird poetry readings, and then there's a sort of collective feast that happens every year too. So Ben makes a mothball cake that is pretty wild, and yeah.
What's the name of the road that you live on, and how did it come to be named that?
So we live on Wushy Woods. Woods is an acceptable suffix for road, so it's not Wushy Woods Lane or Wushy Woods Road. We live in the Wushy Woods, and yeah, we like Wushy because it's the dress code for mothball. It's mm-hmm. also a quality two gays might bring to a woods, a wushiness, if you will. And also, the woods are just making that sound all the time, which is great, whether we're there or not. And the experience of naming the road was one that was very funny because the village of Athens had not had to name a road in over 20 years. So it became this, like, all-consuming project where I, like, met Heidi from the Greene County 911 Emergency Services office, and I met Don, the deputy village clerk in Athens, and I was interfacing with Ed and Jeff, the code enforcement officers in Athens, and we were all just, like, trying to figure out the process for naming a road. And in the end, they made me and Ben submit three different possible names. So we had Wushy Woods, Sweet Sap Forest, or Hoot Hollow. And now our neighbors who we share a driveway with also live in the Wushy Woods, maybe much to their chagrin.
I like how the town of Caro chose what was probably the weirdest of the names.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you're happy with that?
Yeah, yeah. Town of Athens. Yeah, they had us rank them, and then like a some board or something like votes or discusses them, and I think that they were like, yeah, well, there's nothing else. We can't fault them for it. And everyone was kind of like, huh, okay. I guess that's what they're going to go with.
Yeah. And to wrap up, I guess, can you tell people where they can learn more about your work?
Yeah, so I have a website. It's patrickjcostello.net. And I'm on Instagram, too. And the project that I'm going to be doing next is I'm the performing artist in residence at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. And so there will be a performance of the work that I'm developing there with a bunch of the people that I have mentioned on this podcast. And that will happen at the end of September at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden.
Great. Well, Patrick, it was awesome to get to learn about your work. And thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. So fun. Thank you.